Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what can we make of the latest revelations from inside the Trump administration? We spend the hour with three top scholars of the U.S. presidency. George C. Edwards III is a distinguished professor of political science and presidential studies at Texas A&M University. His books include Predicting the Presidency, The Strategic President, Governing by Campaigning, and On Deaf Ears, The Limits of the Bully Pulpit. Jeremy Suri also joins us. He is a professor in history, public affairs, and is a distinguished chair for leadership in global affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, Henry Kissinger and the American Century, and Liberty's Surest Guardian, American Nation Building from the Founders to Obama. David Stepan is with us. He is professor of history and law at The Ohio State University. He's the author of New Deal Liberal and Modern Republican, Arthur Larson in the Eisenhower Years. So welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you with us. Thanks so much.
Happy to be here.
A pleasure.
I'd like to start with this Bob Woodward book, actually. This presidency is described in some ways that are rarely heard, like Crazy Town. All three of you are scholars of U.S. politics. How would you contextualize this sort of state of affairs in the arc of U.S. politics? George Edwards, would you start, please?
If by contextualize you mean giving it a little perspective, I think that this is distinctive. This is unusual. It's an aberration. We have not had a president who is so impulsive, so ill-informed in his policies and his thinking about policy and his policy decisions. That does not mean they're all wrong. It doesn't mean his aspirations are wrong. That's an entirely separate matter. But the way he approaches decision-making is a matter of concern. And I think that that really is one of the most important aspects of Woodward's book. I would say there's a substantial degree of willful ignorance here, and I don't think that's ever a good basis for making policy. And I think there's also a problem of just organizing a decision-making system. That's not good for policy. They're not good for decision-making. So I think that this is distinctive and it's troublesome.
Jeremy Suri.
I agree 100%. We have never had a president in the modern era who seemed so unconcerned about acquiring good information and hearing multiple points of view. We've had many presidents who had strong opinions and strong programs, but they generally seek to at least, especially on national security issues, understand the issues more deeply and draw experts to them. And what we're seeing is overwhelming evidence that this is an administration and a president who seeks to remain ignorant willfully and acts in impulsive, thoughtless ways with major national security issues. So this is deeply frightening and deeply unprecedented.
What examples would you give us to illustrate that, Jeremy Suri?
So one of the examples that has come up in a number of contexts, including Bob Woodward's book, but not only in Bob Woodward's book, we've seen other evidence of this, is with regard to U.S. policy concerning North and South Korea, Japan, China, and East Asia. It appears, and it has been confirmed from multiple sources, that the president has not taken the time to consider America's security interests and guarantees to South Korea, has switched positions multiple times, claimed that he had a breakthrough or an agreement with the North Korean leader when he did not, agreed to things with the North Korean leader that he did not tell other members of his administration or allies about, and at the same time has pursued a set of arbitrary tariff decisions that have also not been vetted nor coordinated with other parts of his administration. And what we've seen from multiple sources is members of his administration struggling to figure out what he has agreed to, and also struggling then to accommodate and contain these contradictory impulsive agreements. And this involves trillions of dollars of potential economic trade, and also potentially nuclear weapons. So this is the scariest of the examples and the one we have the most evidence upon.
David Stebbin.
The one thing I'd like to amplify, building on what Jeremy Suri said, was that qualification he put in early in his remarks, where he talked about the presidency in the modern era. Because, of course, we've had the presidency for a long time, and Andrew Jackson was a populist, the first in some ways, and he was viewed as utterly unqualified to be president by most of the Eastern elite and the political establishment. He had a very violent temper. He would make decisions of very vast importance, such as destroying the Bank of the United States, even though Orthodox opinion said that was a terrible idea. But the point is, the American presidency didn't matter to the world anywhere near as much when Jackson was president in the 1830s as it does today. So the modern presidency is really a creation of Franklin Roosevelt in the 30s and the 40s. And we haven't had an Andrew Jackson-like president since the modern presidency was created until Donald Trump.
So one of the things that Woodward's book has revealed is the extreme action by some of the aides, the presidential aides. For example, like physically taking documents to prevent a really terrible policy. George Edwards, have we ever seen anything like this?
Certainly not systematically. I mean, I don't think we can say definitively that no document has ever been lifted from the president's desk, but certainly not systematically, nor would a president ever tolerate such a thing once he knew about it. But I think that because of the nature of President Trump's approach to decision-making and his own personality, that people are trying to save him from himself. Now, it is the case that many presidents have tempers. Many presidents have bad days, and many presidents have issued orders which, upon reflection, they just assume not be carried out. And good aides know this. They understand that, and they just drag their feet a bit on such an order. But it seems like President Trump does this with an alarming regularity, and that's the real concern. And so you end up with chaos and unsystematic kind of efforts to contain him, or to contain his impulses and contain the worst consequences of his impulses.
I wonder, and this is just to scholars, people who study American presidency, Congress, government, does this presidency sort of disrupt everything we've known as scholars, George Edwards?
Well, no, I don't think it does. There are different aspects of a presidency. We've been talking about decision-making, and that's certainly a crucial one. But let's talk about very quickly a couple of others. One is the presidents spend a lot of their time dealing with the public and trying to public support, which they enjoy, but also want to use that as leverage, particularly with Congress. Presidents have a very difficult time obtaining public support, and President Trump is no exception. It's perfectly predictable, I think. In fact, I wrote a piece in the Washington Post right after his election saying he's not going to win public support for his policies. And if you look at health care, if you look at tax, you look at immigration, the public doesn't support them. That doesn't inherently mean that they're wrong, but the public doesn't support them. So in that way, he's like other presidents, even though he has the Twitter feed, even though he dominates the news perhaps more than any president. And we look at his relations with Congress. Presidents frequently have a face gridlock. They frequently have problems getting their way. This president has certainly had a difficult time, despite having majorities of both houses of Congress, Republicans majorities in both houses of Congress. And that's why we don't have a health care plan. And that's why we don't have an immigration plan, nor do we have infrastructure plan. And those are three major components of his presidential campaign in 2016. Partly, I think, because there's dissension within the Republicans, and partly because he's not peculiarly competent as a negotiator and a deal maker. But it's not breaking the mold that presidents have difficulty in dealing with Congress.
Well, it seems like in some ways difficulty in dealing with Congress, but in other ways they have been a big support for Donald Trump. Before we go into that, though, I just want to do a quick follow-up on that point that you made about the policies, George Edwards, and that's because I read chunks of your paper. And that is one of the points that you made in that paper is that he not only did not get the policies more popular, he made them unpopular. Like he made a healthcare policy that had been unpopular more popular, whereas the tax cut you would think would be popular made it unpopular. How does that happen, or why does that happen?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. It's difficult to move public opinion because they have strong predispositions, et cetera. There's lots of reasons that opinion's not malleable. But I also think that his approach to taking a case to the public doesn't help. So it's a very alarmist approach. It's a very crass approach. And so it tends to alienate people who are already likely to respond negatively to whoever is in power. That's just the way Americans tend to react to a new president. But I think with his peculiar rhetoric, that he certainly has not helped himself.
David Stebbin, would you agree?
Well, there are a couple of issues that are challenging in this. One is this issue of how much support does he have? I have a sort of personal trainer for polling because I don't know a lot about the mechanics of polling, but there are very serious scholars who do. And so I talked to this fellow who's in our political science department, internationally known, and he says that response rates for most telephone polls are in the single digits. And so we have these endless polls that tell us how popular the president is and how much approval there is for his policy, but it's not clear that we should necessarily believe them. So, and we, for decades, the polling industry was very reliable. Landlines were there, not cell phones, and they were adults home, and they were socialized to pick up the phone when the telephone rang. And so we had very reliable polling. And I think there's probably some gray in the hair of all three of your interview subjects today. And so we can remember that era. And so we have this reflex that says polls are accurate. But a lot of people who study polling think that we may be in an era when most polling is really unreliable. So there's that problem. Another is the sort of crass approach to winning support. It is true. It is jarring and so on. But the point is, Donald Trump has never been very popular with highly educated people. He doesn't win, do really well with college graduates and so on. It's less clear to me, and this is a challenge for all university professors, does his approach work better for people with, say, no more than a grade school education or maybe 1 year at a community? In other words, the people who are not so highly educated. And that I don't know. It's hard to be sure about that. And so just to give one example, here in Ohio, we have 88 counties, and Columbus, where Ohio State is, has the highest fraction of college graduates, and it was his worst county, even though he won Ohio decisively. So the method that he uses is not one that ordinarily has worked in recent decades. But again, as part of his populist appeal, maybe it works for him. It's all too early to tell, I think.
This is George Edwards. If you don't mind, I'd like to just say something there. If it were the case that polls were just randomly unsystematic, we wouldn't find them all coming to the same conclusion. And the fact is that the evidence is overwhelming and it's very consistent about the level of support for him and his policies. And if that's the case, if I'm right that the polls are reasonably correct, then we can talk about does Trump's rhetoric and approach and policy stances work with a certain segment of the public, and we'll call that his base. And that's a very good question, and I think the answer is yes, it does. His base has been extremely, extremely loyal and very stable. And that's one of the fascinating things about the Trump presidency is there's usually a fair amount of volatility and approval for presidents, but for President Trump, there's been very little. And if you look at his approval rating, it has been almost astonishingly stable, around the 40% mark from the day he took office until today. And so there's a base out there for which his message resonates, and they are being very loyal to him. The problem for him is that the base is 40%, and that's not a majority. And that is one reason why Republicans are very nervous about the midterm elections.
Well, this is what I was going to ask, is how that translates.
The one thing I wanted to say is there have been some major polling gaps in recent years. The British and American polling industries are very closely related, and they have bungled the last few general elections. They got Brexit wrong. The polling industry got the election here in 2016 wrong from the point of view of many people. So there's this concern, very real concern, that even if all the polls come to the same results, all the major British newspapers predicted Brexit would be defeated, and then it won, that sort of thing. So just because they agree doesn't mean they're accurate. But again, I'm not an expert on the polling industry. I defer to others, and perhaps Professor Edwards has done more work on that. The one other thing I did want to say, though, is that Ohio is an interesting case study because it's a bellwether kind of state, unlike Texas, where professors Edwards and Surrey are, which is very consistently Republican in presidential elections. Ohio is a kind of purple state, and President Trump won decisively here. And a lot of ordinary Ohioans they're not paying a lot of close attention to this, the kinds of stories that are being generated about the Trump presidency. So there is a segment of the population that is very focused on this, and a lot of them are natural opinion leaders in some ways. But a lot of Donald Trump's base, as Professor Edwards describes them, essentially tune this out. It's just noise.
I wonder also, you know, there's so many directions to go in for this conversation, but one of the things that I wonder about frequently is, you know, as the media have become increasingly polarized in the United States and how one segment listens to a very positive framing of Donald Trump in, say, a Fox News or a Breitbart, whereas on the, you know, the other end of it, the people who are educated, reading whatever it is, the New York Times or listening to NPR or reading the Washington Post, they are getting this information. So, you know, is this also a crisis of information?
So I'll come in on this. This is Jeremy Suri. I don't think that is unprecedented. For a long time, Americans have watched and listened to different sources. If you go back to the 19th century, most cities had multiple newspapers, and the newspapers were owned by political parties, and people from one party read one newspaper, from another party read another. There was this strange moment in American history between the mid-40s and the mid-60s when there really was a mainstream media of Walter Cronkite and others that people bought into largely. So I don't think this is abnormal right now. I think the challenge is the speed at which Twitter and social media move stories, and the ability with more outlets for people to put stories into the conversation that do not have any factual basis, do not have any editorial content to them. And so that's one of the challenges. But I think the challenge that Donald Trump faces right now is there are only so many positive spins you can put on the barrage of bad news. Michael Cohen did admit and has claimed to conduct illegal activities with the president's knowledge. Paul Manafort was convicted. Bob Woodward has written his book. These things are happening. And I think even on the president's more favorable outlets like Fox News, it's harder and harder to put a positive spin. That doesn't mean they're going to be negative toward him. But framing does have some verisimilitude at some basic level to the facts. And I think the president's running up against that. And I do think that's why even in the polls that Professor Edwards referred to, we've seen, at least since McCain's death, we've seen somewhat of a drop for Trump. And I do think that's significant.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with top presidency scholars George Edwards, Jeremy Suri, and David Stebbin. So let's talk a bit about the constitutional structure and what I think all of you had talked about in your work to some degree about the presidency and the general lack of power because of the power sharing arrangement, supposedly separation of powers and that sort of a thing. But we do have a Congress that is seeming to be supportive. And now that we've lost John McCain, the one who tended to not be supportive of the president, sort of for that seemingly partisan power perspective. What are we facing in terms of the presidential power now? George Edwards, you start.
The Republicans in Congress have not been antagonistic to Trump, by and large. And that's really his advantage there. Not that they have been supportive in passing major policy initiatives that he wants. He did certainly got tax cuts, and they wanted tax cuts. That's one thing that unifies the Republican Party. And so that was not a major problem for him. But the other major issues they've not been supportive on, except, of course, nominations to the courts, which also unify the Republican Party. But they haven't been investigating him. They haven't been challenging him. They haven't been passing things that would embarrass him that he has to veto. Where he really has exercised his power then, I think, most effectively, most aggressively, has been in unilateral power. And that's unilateral power in an administrative sense. So in the deregulation, one can think of environmental protection and energy matters. And of course, they're related, where he has been able to issue a number of deregulations and fundamentally change, I think, the regulatory structure the way he's implementing policies in other ways. And sometimes it's mean not putting anybody in a position. Sometimes it's meaning transferring senior people to other positions. But they have aggressively tried to take control of the bureaucracy and to do what they can with the president's discretion. We talked quite properly about foreign policy at the beginning of the program, and certainly presidents have a lot of discretion there. And again, he's not really been constrained in that way. He's constrained by the world, but he can engage in whatever provocations that he wishes and whatever negotiations he attempts regarding trade or regarding North Korea and nuclear weapons, or failing to engage in sanctions against, let's say, Russia. So he has a lot of discretion in those areas. He's effectively exercising power there, I think.
Well, let's bring Jeremy Suri into that, because of the book you did, Jeremy Suri, you kind of referred to him as the president as destroyer, which is what it sounds like a little bit in the regulatory matters. But you also called him sort of the antithesis of what, you know, the constitutional framers originally had envisioned. How do you see this?
Yes, well, I think it's quite clear the constitutional framers envisioned a system of checks and balances, but they also envisioned that the president would work with Congress. And what's most striking is that, with the exception of tax cuts and court nominations, and those are big exceptions, members of Congress, even in Trump's own party, have not worked closely with him. I don't think they've been supportive. I don't think they've resisted him either. They have simply sought to distance themselves from him. And it's a very strange thing, actually. So they have actually, in cases of Russia and other issues, passed strong sanction measures that run against his wishes. They have made it clear to him, though not in a way that's legislatively enforceable necessarily, but they have made it clear to him they don't want him to fire Robert Mueller. They have made it clear to him they don't want him to fire Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. And those are probably the reasons he hasn't done that yet. So they have asserted themselves, Congress has, in certain ways, but it's really been an adversarial relationship and a relationship of do as little as possible on the public record. And that's not what the founders intended. They intended for Congress to be a place for debate over Congress's agenda and the president's agenda. And the striking part of the last year and a half is the Trump measures have not really been debated at Congress. And that's where I think he's the biggest destroyer. He's moved us away from having productive policy debates to having debates that are really about name calling and power pushes rather than serious discussions. There are legitimate differences of opinion on many issues, including the confirmation of nominee Kavanaugh right now at the Supreme Court. But instead of having a debate, what we're having is instead a shouting match, and he's encouraging that. That is not the intention for deliberative governance, and that's what we're going to have to redesign and reawaken after his presidency.
One of the phrases you used in an opinion piece, I think it was the Capital Times, was constitutional crisis. Now, that was in relation to Russia, but it sounds like from what you're saying now that constitutional crisis may have been slightly averted given Congress's response. What do you think on that?
I think immediate constitutional crises have been averted because there has not been a moment where the president has done something and Congress or the military has had to tell him no in explicit public terms. They found ways around that with regard to the military parade and various other issues. But I do think we're approaching that moment. It looks to me like he's becoming more and more desperate, and he's doing things for which people might not be able to steal the document off his desk before he signs it. And that puts us in a really difficult situation. If he gives an order to the military to do something that the military believes is an illegal order, meaning it does not serve the interests of the Constitution in the United States, members of the military are required under their code of ethics to resist that order. And that's the space I am afraid we're moving into. The same could be true for the Justice Department. If he were to try to order the Justice Department to stop investigating his enemies, that would be an unconstitutional order. And members of the Justice Department would have to resist that. And I think we're at the precipice of that. And I even predict we're going to see something along those lines in the next few weeks.
I suppose he has been pushed into a bit of a corner. And now that he knows people are stealing documents off of his desk, that it could very well turn into something like this. Previous scholars we've had on this program have expressed concern about turning authoritarian in the United States, like not so far as, say, Turkey, but maybe a Hungary or a Poland kind of a thing. Is this a concern at all that you, either of you, any of you have, David Stebbin?
The issue of how much is appropriate for the president to do and Congress and so on has been debated ever since the modern presidency emerged under Franklin Roosevelt. And the trajectory of the Roosevelt presidency was for the presidency to do ever more and Congress simply to go along. And a lot of people at that time were very angry about that and thought there was something dictatorial about this and so on. And Roosevelt's perspective tended to be there's a crisis, first economic, the Great Depression, then there's a crisis in foreign policy out in the world, and I must do these things because Congress can't or won't do it fast enough, and so on. And by the late 60s and beyond, a reaction against that. And so the generation of political scientists who came of age in the 70s and the 80s were all about, let's strengthen Congress, and that's what our system is meant to be like, and the presidency shouldn't do as much. What's been fascinating since early in the 2000s is the revival of a strong presidency model. So Congress has become steadily less productive, and presidents in both parties have taken on more responsibility. President Obama signed all these executive orders. President Trump is a strong presidency type. And he hasn't recreated the Rooseveltian presidency at its peak, but the trajectory is in that direction. Whether or not that's unconstitutional is a really interesting question. In the last resort, whatever the Supreme Court says is unconstitutional, but he keeps adding people to the court. And the person currently being considered tends to believe in the strong presidency idea, Judge Kavanaugh. So it's not clear to me that he's going to get into, you know, huge trouble this way. What is clear to me is the presidency is becoming more important in the system again.
This is George Edwards. You ask about authoritarianism, and I certainly don't think we're about to turn into an Eastern European nation, but I do think that it is worrisome when the president says, I think we should outlaw protesting, or when he delegitimizes the press, because the First Amendment is really critical for democracy to work. And so while I don't think people are going to necessarily roll over dead and say, yes, I agree completely, but a lot of people apparently will agree with the president on this, and that is not good for the system. That's really going at the fundamental principles and the fundamental infrastructure of our whole system of government. And so we have to nurture that. We have to protect that.
Jeremy Suri, was that you coming in a minute ago?
Yes, no, and I was just going to build on the excellent comments by my colleagues here. I don't think we're moving toward authoritarianism. In fact, I see a very positive development, which we're seeing in all sorts of quarters, which is that the Trump presidency and his authoritarian words and actions are actually motivating more people to get involved and more people to resist and more people to demand and defend basic democratic principles than ever before. The Democratic Party is embracing a much more participatory and democratic approach to immigration than it ever did before in reaction to Donald Trump. So I think we're seeing some very positive tendencies outside of the White House, and maybe, as the piece in the New York Times shows, maybe even within the White House. I don't think we're moving toward authoritarianism, but I think we are moving toward more strife, more conflict. And the civil strife and violence are not good things for a healthy democracy. And that's really what I worry about. I worry about the divisions between what are becoming different camps and different groups arguing for different positions. That will prevent authoritarianism, but it can bring many other negative repercussions for our society.
This is George Edwards. If I could add just one other thing. One of the great concerns I have is what the president is doing to the nature of public discourse. And we've mentioned several times today that the nature of his discourse is name-calling, it's crass. And instead of saying, I disagree with your policy and here's why and here's my alternatives, it's I disagree with your policy, but you're really a very bad person and your motives are highly suspect. And that's what you really need to know, because you're crooked Hillary or lying Ted Cruz or whatever, and therefore we don't really have to pay attention to you. We can't really have a good discussion. And so I am very much concerned about what's going to happen when the president is no longer president. Will we be able to bounce back and have a more civil and productive discourse? And I don't know the answer to that. I certainly hope we can.
So I wonder if we could also back up a little bit. Actually, David, did you have one last comment to make? Was that?
One thing I wanted to add is that, building on what's already been said, is as discouraging as the way the president talks about public policy and issues, the impression I have is that many of his strongest supporters pay no attention to the way he talks, right? In other words, they just discount. They're interested in sort of outcome. So if he gets a better trade deal with Mexico from their point of view, they don't necessarily like the way he talks, but they're not focused on words. They're focused on sort of deeds or outcomes. And of course, there's some relationship between the two, but the point is among highly educated people, very well-spoken and so on, they're more jarred by this than seemingly a lot of other kinds of folks who are attracted to what he's promised to do and don't particularly like or pay a lot of attention to what he says about it.
I think there is an alternative view of that. The best data that we have is that when they ask people, what do you like about Donald Trump? People who like him, what do you like? And what comes out first is his personality and actually how he says things. They like the fact that he is giving the establishment the finger, so to speak. And they seem to like that, for better or worse. And they like his approach to discourse. I find that very troublesome.
You know, that brings up a piece that you wrote, George, which is the thing about the bully in the pulpit, right? And it does seem like there's an enormous amount of anger among his supporters, and that they must feel so wronged in a way that they like that kind of rhetoric. They like having a bully on their side. Is there anything you can bring to light about that?
Well, I think that we are in an age of identity politics, and I think we have a pretty good sense of that now. And some people feel that they are under siege, that they're economically under siege, that they're culturally under siege. And we know that many of Trump's supporters have racial resentment. Many of Trump supporters are also fear change, social change, and demographic change. And so this doesn't get articulated in many elements of politics. So now they've got someone who does that. And I think that's resonating with them. And they find it appealing. And I think they find his aspirations to make America great again, maybe a misremembered America, but to make America great again, to do something for the working guy and that's or gal. And I think that's how they're thinking about this. Here's a guy who's standing up for us and who's telling it like it is.
Even though he's not really. He's not only not telling it like it is, he's not standing up for the little guy.
Well, I would say he's telling it like it isn't. But
yeah.
But they think he's telling it like it is. And they think, hey, this is a guy who's going out and negotiating new trade agreements or trying to negotiate trade agreements and slapping tariffs on other nations. And he's doing that in the interest of steel workers or coal miners or whatever. And therefore, see, he's really looking out for our interests. And it's the perception, of course, which helps put together a coalition.
Right. So reality just doesn't really come into play there because people aren't keeping up with the reality. I mean, most people are not policy experts, right?
They're not. And international trade is a rather abstract subject to most people. Now, on the other hand, if prices start to rise because of tariffs, if people lose jobs because of tariffs, that's another question. People do understand that. So we'll just have to see how this plays out.
I just wanted to come in on that if I could. This is Jeremy Suri. I do think there's an important element of this that where the history is important here. It's not entirely new that large parts of the American public like to see someone stick his finger at the establishment. And I think a lot of what George is referring to is this sort of ecstasy that certain people have in finding that there's someone who's finally standing up and saying, this is the quote you see a lot in polls, he's saying what needs to be said, and that everyone else is afraid to say this. And that includes racist things, misogynist things, et cetera. That's not new. But what we do know, at least from other historical cycles, is that wears off pretty fast. You know, that's exciting. It's self-actualizing for groups that feel left out. but it doesn't, it, after a while, it gets old and it doesn't actually do anything for them. And I do think that's part of the issue here is he keeps upping the rhetorical temperature, but it's not clear that it's going to continue to have the ecstasy effect it has for certain listeners who are looking for someone to stick their eye in the establishment. After you've done that for so long, what value does it have anymore? And that's at least been the historical experience if we go back to other periods from the late 60s and even earlier.
And then there will be the policy results as well.
And this is David Stabenow, and that was going to be my addition. In other words, I think Jeremy Suri is exactly right on that point. What would have to happen in addition is he has to deliver at least some of the policy goods that he's promised. So when he campaigns for re-election, assuming he does, if he can do a commercial that shows a steel mill somewhere in the Midwest that's making a lot of steel that basically was shuttered 4 years earlier, then there's the message that I'm making America great again for ordinary working people, especially guys. So, and the question, of course, is can his economic policies produce those results? And it's still a little early to tell, or enough results to make a difference.
Now I have a burning question, and I'd like to see if we can do a little analysis on here to get to this, which is really, if you were going to look across, you know, the last few decades, what would you say have been the primary factors that have led us to this? George Edwards?
Well, you know, one of the great questions in American politics today is how did we get so polarized? And that's part of this. We have highly polarized opinion. But it's also the case that if you look at the name, if you mean how did we get to this, why does the president's base have the views that they have? And one of the things that has happened in America, and it's happened many times in America, is that we have demographic change. And so there is change, and it is interesting that some people have a fear of this change. In Texas, whites are a minority, and it's really not a big problem for us. But apparently, and the data show that the further away people are from immigrants, for example, the more fear or distrust they have of them. And so there has been a building concern about immigrants and demographic change. So that's one thing that seems to be driving this unrest. Another thing that's driving the unrest is the fact that we have not had, particularly blue collar workers, but also lower middle class workers, white collar workers, have not had, and you can trace it to 20 years, 30 years, whatever, have not really had real income increases. And so there's been a stagnation in their incomes. And of course, in some areas, with the opioid crisis and the combination of that with a stagnation in wages, that people really feel they're being left behind or they're very disappointed, they're very discouraged, they're very discontented. And so the president has been able to take these trends in society, and I don't think that he created these problems, and he didn't create these ideas and these people's minds. But he's been able to capture them and design a message that people respond to.
And if I could jump in, David Stebbin, just add a third one to that demographic change / immigrants and the blue collar and lower middle class folks not getting income growth. In those same decades, steadily lower barriers to trade with low wage countries, most notably China. So put all those together, as the president does, he makes an argument that they are all related, and more immigrants and lower barriers to trade has meant ordinary working folks and lower middle class folks are falling farther and farther behind.
And Maria, if I might come in on this, I think all of this is correct, but I actually think this is a case where there's a very simple explanation. Well, let me put it this way. What I'm going to mention now, if it did not exist, we wouldn't have Donald Trump. And that is the deep, deep fear that white men, especially above the age of 45 in the United States, have, that they are falling behind, and that the power that they have exerted in political, economic, and social and cultural terms for quite a long time, that when America was great in the past, in their eyes, in their mythical view, that they're losing that. It's white male privilege, and that's driving more of this than anything else. It's the diversification of our society and the challenges to white male privilege that Donald Trump is speaking to and appealing to.
And just to be clear on that, David Stebbins again, it's not entirely illusory. In the spring of 1963, a time when Donald Trump folks think America was great, 60% of all college grads earning a degree were male, and 40% were female. And now it's the reverse. So men in some very important areas are now substantially behind, not at the very high end of the income distribution, but across the broad middle. That's where men have fallen farther and farther behind.
David, I agree 100%. This is actually where there's a factual basis to the fear that Donald Trump plays to. But it's that fear that's moving us.
So what about some of the other kind of more policy, political, structural issues? Have they played into this as well? So, for example, we know there's quite a bit of gerrymandering that has been orchestrated. We know that we've become more and more of a celebrity culture type of a thing in the United States. We know that there are campaign finance issues that lock out certain candidates. How have these things played into the rise of this situation where we have this government, or do they?
Well, I think that you mentioned several things. One is campaign finance. I don't think that's really the issue for Donald Trump. I mean, Trump was greatly outspent by Hillary Clinton. And so, I mean, he got free media. He's a master at free media and dominating the news. So I don't think that's the explanation. It explains many other things about the nature of American politics, but it doesn't explain the rise of Donald Trump per se. I think that you mentioned celebrity culture, and certainly for whatever reasons, people really seem to like celebrities and give them credibility. So a reality TV star who knows nothing about public policy all of a sudden is a candidate for president of the United States and who remains willfully ignorant about public policy, and people think that's dandy. So I think that the credibility of celebrities is a real problem and certainly is helped Donald Trump. I forgot what other
Oh, I mentioned gerrymandering too, but you know, you don't have to limit it to the things I'm asking. These are just some of the things I've been thinking about. So, yeah, gerrymandering, anything else?
I would also add something we mentioned earlier. You have a fragmented media, so people can live in echo chambers if they wish, and more people do. And so you listen to news that reinforces whatever your views are, and people do that both on the right and the left. And as a result, it's much more difficult to have a dialogue. It's much more difficult to get at real facts. We've also, at the same time, have this delegitimizing of expertise, even the notion of a fact, so people can deny climate change. It seems astonishing to me that you can deny climate change when 99% of the people who studied are on one side. You can talk about the contribution of human beings to climate change. You can have a discussion about what we ought to do about it, et cetera. But to deny the basic fact seems to me indicative of a very serious problem we have and trying to engage in democratic government.
Jeremy Suri.
I think the real issues that are driving what we see now are the overlap of voter restrictions and gerrymandering. And these are not new. They play out in different ways today. But as I always tell people, that the historian in me says, it's not what people think in American society, it's who actually gets to vote and who they vote for. And in the last 10 to 20 years, we've seen a backsliding on voter access, which was never what it should be. We've seen, especially in midterm elections, it'll be different this year, but in most midterm elections, very low turnout in primaries. And then gerrymandered districts using computer programs to create the optimal mix of votes so that you get one party elected in disproportionate number to the actual people who voted for it. And Texas is a great example of this. The city of Austin, where I live, is a largely Democratic city. We have four members of Congress who represent different parts of Austin. Three of them are Republicans, even though the majority of people in Austin actually vote for Democrats. It's the way the districts are drawn. My member of Congress, his district runs from my part of Austin all the way to Houston. It's crazy. So it's the overlap in these figures in the gerrymandering and the voter restrictions that have led us to where we are. But that's why I'm optimistic, because these are issues that are drawing attention now as they have not before in my lifetime. And people are moving to register voters, to get people out to vote, and they are moving to actually take legal and political action to redress some of the gerrymandering problems we face. That will not correct these problems overnight, but it is actually a moment now when we're seeing some action on these issues after too long ignoring them.
This is George again. Related to all that is the Electoral College. I mean, we have Donald Trump because of Electoral College.
Yeah, absolutely.
He got almost exactly 3 million fewer votes than his opponent. Obviously, in any other election, he wouldn't have won. But because of the Electoral College, he did win. This has been a great concern for me for some time. There is a movement abroad to do something about it. And it is a complex matter because it's a way to change the Constitution without amending the Constitution. But at any rate, enough people are concerned that it's just possible, just theoretically possible, that we might be able to do something about that.
This is David Stevin again. There's also a regional dimension to this in the sense that Donald Trump's victory through the Electoral College tally was the result of people who changed their attitudes in the Midwest, from Western Pennsylvania through Wisconsin, that sort of swath. And a lot of those folks were people who used to have jobs in basic manufacturing or the kinds of white-collar jobs connected with those sort of companies, and those jobs either had gone away or in danger of going away, and he spoke to that concern. In other words, there's probably no part of the country where Make America Great Again has more resonance than in the Midwest, because the Sun Belt has boomed since the 1970s. I can't imagine how Sun Belters process that slogan, right? Unless he's just talking about foreign policy and military strength. But in the Midwest, older people, and Donald Trump is older, utterly understand what he's talking about. So there are different factors at work here. And the kind of person who understands him best is literally a contemporary. Donald Trump was born in 1946, the first year of the baby boom. He turned 21 in 1967. And the America that he grew up in is the America to some degree he'd like to restore. And there's a large swath of baby boomer older ones who relate really positively to that message in the Midwest.
So looking ahead, you've said a lot of things that suggest, A, people are really getting more engaged, more savvy in terms of understanding structure and policy, and those are good things. But we've also had the suggestion that, you know, we may have some crazy orders coming from the president, which will lead us into a greater crisis. So looking ahead, looking at all of this, I mean, what kinds of big significant changes do you see? I'll leave that open. Who would like to start?
Well, I'll start on that. This is Jeremy Suri. I think, first of all, the election in November is going to be very, very important. And I do foresee the Democrats taking control of the House and perhaps taking control of the Senate. That's going to come down to the wire. It's going to come down to the Texas race for Senate, I think, actually, between Beto and Cruz. But I think we're going to see a Democratic House with Adam Schiff from California, who's been the junior member of the House Judiciary Committee, now having subpoena authority. And in January of 2019, he's going to subpoena Donald Trump's tax returns, as well as many other things. And Donald Trump is going to try to refuse to turn those over. And there we're going to be at another crisis moment. But it's going to be a very different moment from where we are now, because you will have congressional power mobilized, at least in one house, if not in both, against Donald Trump. I do think he'll be impeached. And whether he'll be convicted or not will be an interesting part of the story.
Because that would be a first in American history, wouldn't it?
Well, we've had other presidents. We've come close before. We had President Clinton impeached.
But we've never had a conviction.
That's true. We were very close with Andrew Johnson. Yeah. Yeah. That would be a first. We'll see.
This is George. I certainly agree that the House will rev up the investigations and Trump will be on the defensive all the time. And that's going to suck out much of the air of politics, and we're not going to see major advances in legislation or major advances in solving problems. But there will be constraints on the president. And it'll also make it less attractive for people to work for the president because they are going to be under the watchful eye of Democrats in Congress. Whether he's impeached or not, I'm not sure. But there's certainly a decent chance. I don't think there's any chance that he'll be convicted unless something is revealed that we don't know right now, because I don't think the Republicans in the Senate are going to convict him. And then we will, of course, almost immediately go into the 2020 presidential election. And the focus will be on the alternatives to Donald Trump. And one of the questions will be, will there be a Republican who will run against him in the primaries? And I have no idea about that, but it's certainly possible. And I won't say anything about Governor Kasich because we have an expert here on him. So I'll leave that to him. But certainly there'll be a lot of attention, of course, on who the Democratic nominee will be.
David, you've been prompted.
I'd first like to talk about the issue of Congress and impeachment. The previous efforts to impeach presidents, and we've had three, Andrew Johnson, after President Lincoln, of course, and Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton, were all partisan. In other words, the two houses of Congress that are involved in this process were controlled by the other party from the White House. And if the Democrats don't pick up control of Congress, it's hard for me to see how impeachment will proceed. I don't see the Republicans impeaching their own president, so to speak, especially because he's so popular with much of the Republican base and members of Congress are terrified of him. You know, he'll come into their district and campaign against them. So in terms of Jeremy Suri's prediction about the electoral outcome, I think it's possible the Democrats could win the House. I think it's also distinctly possible that more people could vote for Democratic congressional candidates nationally, and yet the Republicans still control the House, because of the extensive gerrymandering in many, many states. So the people, if you want to put it that way, in one sense, might vote for a Democratic House, but they might not get one. So, and I think the polling is sufficiently unreliable that we won't know, right? Much depends on turnout. Is President Trump's base depressed by all this bad news in the media, or do they just tune it out? Are other people so angry on the Democratic side that they turn out in an unexpectedly large number? And we'll see about that. I am utterly confident in terms of policy outcomes that the president will continue to push his trade and immigration agenda. And both of them are very popular in the Midwest. And on the trade front, I think the next big thing is Canada. If the Canadians essentially fold and give Donald Trump a major concession on trade, then when he runs for re-election in a couple of years, he can say that I redid NAFTA in a way that's better for American workers and their families. And that'll be a big plus for him.
You know, you mentioned the who votes mattering so much, who actually gets out to vote, who's able to vote. And I understand that there are certain states that are removing polling places, particularly from black districts and that kind of a thing. I think I saw it particularly in Georgia. Do you know if that is more frequent than just, you know, the places in Georgia, and if that is going to play a significant role?
Well, I work with election law experts at Ohio State School of Law, the Moritz College of Law, and they study these things, the legal issues and so on. And part of the challenge is a lot of the machinery that was purchased after the 2000 election problems is wearing out. State budgets are tight. The federal government isn't providing a lot of new money, so some of the machinery is breaking down, so there's less of it. And then state elections officials have to make decisions about where people are most likely to turn out in large numbers and then allocate resources accordingly. And sometimes they get it right and sometimes they get it wrong. And is there a certain amount of room for partisan officials to play games with this? There absolutely is. So there's a lot of pressure on the machinery, literally and metaphorically, to help one party or the other. And the Republicans at the state level are in really good shape in much of the country. So that also helps them.
So again, this is Jeremy Suri. I'm a little more optimistic than David, but I agree with what he said. I'm optimistic because the press is focusing on this more than they ever have in recent memory. And part of the problem we had with our elections for the past 7, 8, 9 times through, going back 2000 and much earlier, is that we had come as Americans to be very complacent about the way our elections work. From the founding, people have manipulated where voting booths are. They've manipulated when they're open. This is an old, old story. And it generally works because people don't pay attention. But we are paying so much more attention now. And the newspapers paying attention, especially at the national level, are so much better at covering this and have so many more readers. I actually think there's more light being shed on this, and there's more of a public accountability than there has been before, at least on the issue of where polls should be open. So in Georgia, they actually had to reverse their decision because of all the coverage that was brought to that issue. So I'm reasonably optimistic that this will actually be a fairer election than the last one or the ones before that.
Really speaks to the importance of the press, too. So something else
Absolutely.
To keep an eye on. Well, gentlemen, I thank you so much for sharing your research, your thoughts, your analysis with us here on the Scholar Circle. It's been wonderful to host you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
George C. Edwards III is a distinguished professor of political science and presidential studies at Texas A&M University. Jeremy Suria is a professor in history, public affairs, and is a distinguished chair for leadership in global affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. And David Stebbin is a professor of history and law at The Ohio State University.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.